Per capita has just finished doing an in-depth look at housing prices and why they're so out of reach for many Australians. Can you give us a little understanding of some of the key findings of your report?
Sure. So we were commissioned by the V&F Housing Enterprise Foundation, which is a new philanthropic trust, to undertake a landscape view of the entire housing market, or of housing affordability in Australia. We didn't want to just look at ownership, Annie. We wanted to look at everyone. So private renters, people in social and community housing, etc. To really get a sense of what the affordability crisis is, and it is a crisis, and who it was affecting. And what we found is it's basically affecting everyone that doesn't own more than one property. If you're an average homeowner, you may be feeling wealthier because your house has gone up significantly in value over the last few years. But unless you sell or refinance that house, you can't really reap the benefits of it. You can borrow more against the equity in your home to make home improvements or buy another property, but then you're still taking on more debt and you always have to have somewhere to live. For renters, we're seeing significant increases in rental stress and in mortgage stress throughout Australia, but particularly in lower and middle income areas, outer suburban areas, regional areas and rural areas. And at social and community, so public and community housing, social housing, we've seen our share of housing stock, that is social housing, declined from 6% 30 years ago to about 3% today. And the people that need that low income housing, secure housing provided by the state or by non-profit community housing providers, are waiting sometimes up to 10 years to get a place. So there's a lot of pressure throughout the system, and there are simply not enough ways and enough pathways for Australians to find themselves a secure and decent home.
And so this is not just something that's happened out of the blue. It's been growing over 30 years. It's a policy-driven result, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So we found probably the single biggest driver of accelerating land prices was the introduction of the capital gains tax discount in 1999. And at that point, we saw land values in Australia really take off as people were encouraged by that taxation policy to use property as a place to park and grow capital. To if you've got a bit of extra money, put it into property because you will realise a significant capital gain as the market appreciates, and you'll only pay 50% of the tax you would have paid on that capital gain. We actually tax income from the growth of assets much more lightly than we tax income from work. And so what that and a series of other policy issues on both the demand and supply side, negative gearing, and then on the supply side, a lack of appropriate medium density housing in the suburbs and inner and middle suburbs where people want to work within commutes of their jobs, and a failure to invest adequately in enough a social housing stock or to maintain and repair the social housing stock that we have. All of these things together have created a situation in which our housing market has become financialised. It's become a means of growing wealth for those who have capital. And it has not, public policy has been focused very much on that wealth building aspect and not on where it should be in housing policy, which is ensuring everyone can have a decent home.
Now let's go to how public housing and social housing actually affects the actual cost of houses and land, how it has a positive effect for everybody.
Well, if we built more social housing, what we effectively do, and we create more secure social housing for people at the lower end of the income scale, and particularly those people on fixed incomes like pensions and income support, then what that does is take pressure off the low end of the rental market, the private rental market, which means there are more affordable private rentals for people in the middle band who can then save more adequately to become homeowners. But more broadly, having an adequate supply of good, secure, decent quality public housing and community housing as well is absolutely essential to ensure that we don't have, there's 10% of people in this country have persistently lived in poverty now for 30 plus years. We haven't made a dent in that rate of really low income families, people that cannot escape poverty. The number one thing we could do is build more houses for those families so that they can have the security of a roof over their head and begin to build a better life for the next generation. Our failure to invest in public housing isn't just a failure to build more stock, but it's also a failure to keep, to maintain existing public housing stock. And one of the things we've seen is state governments selling off public housing that's in regions of high property value, so most famously in Sydney, overlooking the harbour, and then not use the proceeds of those sales of very valuable property to build even as much public housing, certainly not to build more in other areas. There's also a tendency to push social housing into defined regions. There's a lot of planning restrictions and a lot of residents who object to having social housing in their community. And what we know from overseas practice is that when social housing is scattered throughout the city, it works best, and that people need to have a choice of locations in which they can live. So investing in public housing, government-owned, government-operated public housing is the most important thing that governments could do right now, and increasing community housing, which is still social housing but is operated by non-profits. It isn't as secure for people that really struggle with keeping a roof over their heads, because they do have to break even, so that it's much easier to be evicted from community housing. We need both, and we also need significant alternatives for models of tenure in the middle of the market, so more secure long-term rentals like they have in Europe that are operated by institutional investors that aren't chasing a short-term capital gain and negatively gearing their losses, but are actually looking at investing in large-scale rental properties that will bring them a return and provide secure housing to people that are never going to buy.
There's an awful lot of social engineering that is actually happening using the policies that are in place at the moment. It's often depicted as if it's a free market, but in actual fact, the results are actually quite blunt instruments in social engineering. So what you've got is young people, or people from 40 years old down, are being completely kept out of the housing market because their wages are so low they cannot buy into the housing market, can they?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. We've created a society now, and again, our research shows that at the point the capital gains tax discount was introduced, that's when house prices took off sharply and diverged from wage growth. So what we've created is a society which Australia never wanted to be. We prided ourselves on being a nation of homeowners where working people could get a decent life through hard work. We've now created a society where if you don't have the bank of mum and dad, you don't inherit money or get a gift or a loan from your parents who already are in the market and have capital, you cannot afford to buy a decent home just off the fruits of your work, of the fruits of your labour. That absolutely must be addressed. We do not want to be a country in which home ownership depends on being born to the right parents, and that's where we've got to. Now, that is absolutely social engineering, and the tax policies that have encouraged investor speculation in the property market over the last 20 to 30 years are a market distortion and a market intervention, and they have been so in the interests of the already wealthy.
The next thing, of course, is that those people who have been able to buy a house or put money down on a house using the bank mum and dad are now paying such exorbitant payments. They're in such debt that,
yes,
as one person said at your lecture, that they can't have a child because they can't afford to.
Yes, it's actually having a huge impact on young people's life decisions. So our report estimates that for anyone born sort of after 1990, home ownership rates by the time they reach 40 will be about 55%. And the historical average in Australia is more like 70. So you're talking about a huge chunk of people that are locked out that in previous generations weren't. And it's preventing them doing things like starting a family. People want a secure home when they want to have a family. And if they can't buy until they're in their 40s or 50s, then those years of having a family are behind them. And there's no alternative for them either, because people don't want to have children when they may be kicked out of their rental property every 12 months. So until we have more secure tenants' rights and longer-term rental agreements in place, there's no alternative for people. So it is having an impact, a significant impact on the life chances and the opportunities of younger people. It's a form of generational theft. And at the other end of the life course, of course, we see a big impact on older women as well. And that's often women or people, but often dominantly women who've lost their home through a divorce or separation and can't afford to get back into the market and don't have enough years then to start over because house prices are so high. The key thing here is to note that 20 years ago, the average mortgage, the average new mortgage taken out in Australia for a home was $200,000. That was about 30 years ago, that was about 2.5 times the average income. It's now $600,000, which is 6 times the average income. So we're creating a debt level on new home buyers that is unsustainable. And as we start to see interest rates rise, as we are now seeing, a lot of those loans will become unaffordable and people will either sell or go into negative equity.
I mean, it's fascinating that you've done this research because the rhetoric that comes from the federal government has always been centred on it's an individual's lot to change their future. But in actual fact, they've created a system that makes that a lie.
Mm. Precisely. They have, and they continue to pay lip service to the Great Australian Dream while enacting policies that put it increasingly out of reach for ordinary people. And I think younger people are awake to this, right? They know what's happened and they know that their chances of having just a normal, secure suburban home in which to raise a family are much, much lower than they were for their parents or grandparents. And they feel betrayed by that, and rightly so.
Well, someone told me the other day that he bought a house in the 1980s and it was $100,000. That same house, he's now divorced, and that same house is now valued at $2.2 million.
Yep, and that's not an unusual tale. Buying a normal suburban 2 or 3 bedroom home in a suburb that's an easy commute of a job in the city now is going to set you back a couple of $1 million. Very few first home buyers are buying detached houses. They're buying units and townhouses, and we don't make enough of them. We don't build enough of those medium density properties that a young family can get a start in. So this is a supply side issue here as well. Our housing stock has been determined by the needs of developers who want to build cheap units that they can make maximum profits off. And that's why we've had such a massive amount of student accommodation over the last 20 years or so. There's not as much profit to be made in a medium density development in a suburb. If you can put 6 or 8 or 10 apartments onto a block instead of 2 or 3 townhouses, then as a developer you're going to do it. But that's not meeting the needs of first home buyers and of downsizers that are looking to get in or stay in the market.
Another anecdote, of course, for me is that someone I know personally, they're intending to try and buy a house in England because it's cheaper.
Yes, absolutely. From a personal anecdote for me, I could sell the place I've lived in for the last 10 years and live mortgage-free in England in a detached house that's considerably bigger than the apartment I've been living in for the last 10 years and did recently move home. Property prices in Australia are amongst the highest in the world. Of the top 12 most expensive markets, we have 3 of them, and Sydney's number 3 behind only Hong Kong and Vancouver in Canada, which are outliers in many ways. So there are people now saying, well, I've got dual citizenship, I'll buy a house in another country and continue to rent here. Because even the strategy that a lot of younger people have taken over the last decade or so of buying in a regional area and renting in the city is becoming out of reach because regional property prices have skyrocketed in the last 2 years as well. So those are rational decisions people are making, but it doesn't provide them with the security of a family home where they want to live.
And I suppose, as an aside, for people who live in the country traditionally, their house values will go up and then their rates will go up, and then a whole lot of those people who've lived there for generations will be pushed out.
And then we're already seeing that happen, Annie, in some, you know, key coastal cities, as people moved out of, particularly in Victoria, as people moved out of Melbourne during the pandemic to get a bit more space and decided, well, I can work from home 3 days a week, so I'll move, you know, to a nice country town or seaside town, push the property prices up considerably, push the rates up, And then locals, essential workers in those towns, can no longer afford to rent or buy within the city that they work in. So that kind of internal migration is also significantly pushing out people from key regional centres.
Let's get on to the lack of legal framework for cooperatives, because that's another way of changing people's futures, isn't it, in the housing area?
It is. It is. And Per Capita's done a lot of work on co-ops over the years, and cooperative housing is a really terrific option in the Netherlands, for example. There aren't many countries in the OECD now that have lower home ownership rates than Australia. Other than the US, they're all Nordic countries, and that's because they have alternative models like co-ops. So cooperative housing is a really fantastic model for people who don't necessarily, who can't necessarily, buy a freestanding property on their own. But we know there are groups at the moment in Castlemaine and in Ballarat, particularly older women coming together trying to form housing co-ops. And we don't have, they can't access finance because the way that our banking system is structured, the way our lending rules are structured, and all of the regulations around home loans make it impossible for people to come together and really, develop cooperative models of housing. So quite apart from the public policy settings around taxation and around supply, there are also issues with our financial regulation that need looking at if we're going to be able to develop some of these models. 60% of Australian retail banking activity is in residential property, and that's very, very high by world standards. It's only 20%, for example, in the UK. So our banks and our financial system is also locked into this paradigm in which property and land is all about amassing more wealth and not about providing homes to people. So we need significant reforms if we're going to make some of these alternative tenure models viable.
Would you call it lazy capitalism?
It is, and it's what happens. It's not just the market being let to rip. As you said, it's by design. A lot of this has been by policy design, or policies being bolted onto each other without an adequate focus on ensuring people have a decent home. Because the market wants to make money. Capitalism is about increasing wealth. And when we apply that to the housing market, guess what? Values go up and wealth goes up, but it's unevenly distributed. And what a whole cry with all of this work, and the VNF Enterprise Housing Foundation as well, and Per Capita both believe really strongly that the number one thing we want to do is change the national conversation so that we start thinking again about housing as primarily a home, a decent home for people, not just a way of making money. If we get to the point where our policies are targeted at ensuring first and foremost that everyone has a decent home, and then there's the capacity to still make some money off the market, there will be, that's fine. But government policy shouldn't be targeted at increasing the wealth of existing homeowners, and particularly investors, at the expense of people's housing security.